Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Elevating the status of Cahokia Mounds. We'll talk a little later about efforts to give the mounds a National Historic Site designation. But we begin by looking at how to decrease the demand for tobacco products. The Washington University Brown School Center for Public Health System Science, CPHSS, produced a series of policy guidelines to help communities decide tobacco control strategies. Tobacco remains the leading cause of preventable death, although the percentage of smokers has been sharply reduced since the U.S. Surgeon General issued the famous report linking smoking to serious diseases 50 years ago. Thousands of new smokers light up every day. How can those numbers be reduced? We'll ask one of those responsible for the report. Douglas Luke is professor in the Brown School at Washington University and director of the Center for Public Health System Science. Doug, nice to see you again. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Don. It's great to be here today.
What sort of response have you had since your guidelines came out a couple of weeks ago?
Well, we've had a great response. The timing was perfect, essentially. We were able to produce the reports the same month that the 50th anniversary Surgeon General's report came out. And also there was an important report that CDC produced. It's an evidence-based guidelines report that's directed at states called best practices. And so all of this came together, and we were able to send our reports out to all the states around the country and many of our tobacco control partners, and there's been a lot of enthusiasm for them.
Also, the CVS drugstores decided not to sell cigarettes at about the same time.
Exactly. We were calling this the CVS experiment. This is a great example of a policy option of reducing the availability of cigarettes, and CVS making that decision partly for marketing reasons, partly for the idea that, you know, drugstores shouldn't be in the cigarette business.
Why is the focus on communities rather than individuals?
Well, it's important both for tobacco control and public health. Public health, especially the last several decades, has taken a real community focus. A lot of the most effective things to do to promote health are policy approaches. And a policy is something that, you know, in the old days, a lot of public health was educational. There'd be health fairs, and public health workers would go and try to teach people what the healthy behavior was. Nowadays, there's much more of a policy approach. And it's much more cost-effective to put a policy in place that affects a whole community or a whole state or a whole region. And so community public health is one of the best ways we have of promoting public health policy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those policies. What kinds of policies are we talking about that don't exist in most communities now?
Well, so in tobacco control, which is one of the oldest areas of public health where we started testing different policies very early on, in fact, since the 60s and the first Surgeon General report, we recognize that there were certain policies that were extremely effective. One is raising the price of tobacco products. Fewer people smoke, fewer people start smoking if the price is higher. And so through taxation policies, through implementing policies of having a minimum price so that tobacco companies can't use, for example, coupons to discount products, we can make it more expensive and thus fewer people are using it. Probably in terms of thinking about communities that have effective policies versus communities that don't, is smoke-free policies. So as recent as the early 90s, very few people in the United States lived in communities that had smoke-free policies, less than 1%. As of this year, about half the country lives either in a state or a community that has strong smoke-free policies. Missouri is in the middle. Missouri does not have a statewide smoke-free policy, but there are communities around the state that have adopted, for example, Clayton locally, have adopted strong smoke-free policies. And that's another reason why we have a community focus, because there are places where maybe a state is not ready to take this up. And so it becomes a grassroots effort where particular communities see that it's important for the residents and promote it at the community level.
When we talk about smoke-free policies, are we talking about being smoke-free in buildings, being smoke-free outside of buildings, or is it just a combination of all of the above?
Well, it's a complicated landscape, but smoke-free policies started with essentially public buildings, so workplaces. Nowadays, restaurants and bars are typically included in smoke-free policies. There are places, for example, Australia is starting to move very strongly in limiting smoking in outdoor public spaces, beaches, yeah. parks. That's something that hasn't happened as much in the United States. There are people who are looking at developing what are called voluntary policies. It sounds like an oxymoron, but having families adopt a smoke-free policy for their home. Now, that's a very different sort of thing than having a formal smoke-free policy like there's no smoking in a hospital. So it is confusing, but essentially smoke-free policies have moved towards protecting kids, protecting workers, and essentially protecting people who have no choice – in the old days would have no choice but be around secondhand smoke.
Are we – on any kind of a slippery slope when we start talking about smoke-free policies in terms of legality, discrimination, that sort of thing?
Well, I'm not a fan of slippery slope arguments, and I think one of the things that protects us with that in public health is we promote what are called evidence-based policies. So we're not trying to put policies out there just because, you know, we're policy fanatics. we put policies out there that science has shown are effective. And in this case, it's in an area where, like you said in your intro, smoking and exposure to tobacco smoke is the number one preventable cause of death and disability in this country and around the world. And so, you know, I don't know about a slippery slope, but we are trying to implement policies that will actually protect people and improve their health and enhance their quality of life.
I ask that because I know a number of smokers, although it's a much smaller number than it used to be, needless to say, who feel in a certain sense discriminated against. You see them standing outside of buildings in the cold having that nicotine fix.
I hear the same thing. And, you know, in some senses, that's one of the intended consequences of smoke-free policies is to change the social norms. It used to be that smoking was a normal thing. So back I was an infant at the time, so I don't remember this myself, but my parents tell me. You know, back in the early 60s, almost one in two adults in this country smoked. If anybody has watched Mad Men, they have a very good depiction of the pervasiveness of smoking, smoking on airplanes, smoking in hospitals, doctors advertising smoking. We forget how far we've come. And one of the things that these policies have done have changed the norms. What we used to think of as normal is now not normal, and we don't accept it as a society.
And if you've forgotten how far we've come, just watch any movie from the 1930s or 1940s.
That's right.
I mean, it makes Mad Men look like abstainers almost. The cigarette was the famous prop. Since the Surgeon General's report came out 50 years ago, there has been an appreciable reduction in the number of people who smoke. How dramatic has that been?
Very dramatic. In fact, public health points to tobacco control as one of the signature successes of the 20th century. Like I said, in the early 60s, no one knew the dangers of smoking, and almost one in two adults. As of last year, the national smoking rate, I think, is right around 19%. Missouri is depending on where you look, is right around the national average. St. Louis City is quite a bit higher, around 26%. But that's a dramatic reduction, and it's millions of lives saved over just a few decades. And so we've come a long way, but there's still a long way to go.
There is indeed, and one of the big targets for the cigarette companies obviously is young people. I mean, I think of Joe Camel, and I think of some of the ads that we see that are certainly geared toward the young. With regard to your recommendations, do you approach that at all?
That's actually how I got into tobacco control, was a study that looked at how teens were responding to tobacco ads and public service announcements. Most people who start smoking or start using tobacco products, the vast majority, more than 90%, start before they're 18. And so policies that look at youth prevention are particularly critical. I don't know if I have time, but last night I was at North Kirkwood Middle School, and walking out, I picked up a snooze tin. Snooze are the smokeless tobacco products, the moist pouches, and I was hoping that was not a middle school student who had dropped that. But we do have to worry about kids starting to use tobacco. tobacco.
We're talking with Douglas Luke, director of the Center for Public Health System Science at Washington University's Brown School, and we were talking about policy recommendations and pricing changes that would induce people to smoke less and to stop altogether. We'll continue that conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to get into the discussion, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back to continue this conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back to our conversation with Doug Luke of Washington University. We're talking about various proposals to reduce the smoking in this country. It's been largely reduced to a very great extent since the U.S. Surgeon General's report came out 50 years ago this year. Doug, back to this talk about young people. A lot of them are smoking these vapor cigarettes today. Did you look at any of this in your study?
Just a little bit. I mean, e-cigarettes are one of the big upcoming challenges. And what's been amazing is how quickly the landscape has changed with these products. E-cigarettes, for people who don't know, they're literally electronic cigarettes. And instead of tobacco, there's a liquid that gets vaporized, and the liquid contains nicotine. Right now, there really aren't a lot of policies in place about e-cigarettes. One, they're too new. We don't really have the science. And one of the worries is we've already started seeing a dramatic increase in youth using e-cigarettes. And so there's clearly going to be a lot more research that's needed and based on that research than policy development.
This seems to be geared more towards secondhand smoke than abstention from nicotine.
Well, one of the tactics or one of the marketing strategies for e-cigarettes is you can in many places, though this is changing, but in many places the policies that limit where you can smoke don't apply to e-cigarettes. Now, some communities are starting to put that in place. It's clear that the vapor is different from smoke, but there's actually some stigma with this. People actually don't like the vapor in their faces either.
And now they're doing the vapor or the contents in all different kinds of fruity flavors and that sort of thing to, again, make them attractive basically to young people.
Yes, and for years we've been trying to eliminate the use of flavoring, for example, because in fact, as you're exactly right, it's very attractive to kids. And because, again, e-cigarettes are not subject to the same regulations, companies have free rein to do whatever they want. And so there's this sense of, you know, two steps forward, one step back.
Let's take some calls. We have a number of people who want to get into the discussion. We'll start with Diane calling from St. Louis. She'll raise an issue that we've already just mentioned. Go ahead, Diane.
Hi. Yes, on the subject of raising the cost of cigarettes to deter people from smoking, I really am not sure if that's going to work all that well, and it's only going to hurt those that are poor. When my husband and I were both out of work, he smoked, and he just couldn't quit. And here we are with food stamps, and he's buying cigarettes. And I feel like it's just going to hurt those that are poor and those that have got money. It's not going to change anything. When you're addicted, and it's just very impossible to quit.
Yes, that's a real dilemma. And in fact, that's what the tobacco industry relies on. The addictive properties of tobacco are what makes it so insidious, that people, you know, when you're addicted, you don't have a choice, or you feel you have no choice. One of the things, and there is worry among policymakers about this discriminatory nature of some of these policies. We want to improve the health of all populations, and we don't want to have policies that have negative consequences for different parts of the population. That being said, one of the most effective parts of raising cigarette prices is it helps prevent new people from starting to smoke. And one of the things here in Missouri, we have the lowest tax rate on cigarettes in the entire country. And it just makes it easier for people to start because the, the cost for starting is much less compared to other places like New York, for
example. We have the lowest tax in the country, but also a higher percentage of smokers here, which kind of makes the point. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, all right. Back to the phones. Diane, thank you for the call. Let's bring in Ed calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Ed.
Yes, you stole my point about about the lowest tobacco tax because you were talking about economics. I grew up 63 years ago near the brewery, and really, I remember I used to go over to the confectionery store and buy candy cigarettes. Really, and they had a little red tip on them, and they were trying to get me to, because I, anyway, I can remember that. And the other thing about economics, I heard on this station overnight that Colorado just made $2 million off of marijuana proceeds in 1 month, which is what they made on alcohol proceeds all last year. So what we need to do is follow the money.
Well, one important point of that is policies that increase pricing through taxation have what we call a win-win element. Not only does it help reduce smoking, but it raises revenues for the state or community that's imposing the tax. And this is something that in many states, they then use those revenues and they feed it back into tobacco control or other public health or health care programs. And so that's what we say that's a win-win.
Interesting to point out here that we're talking about marijuana smoking. We're still talking about smoking. Now, it's only legal in two states at this point, but I wonder if that isn't going to create – more regular smokers, regular tobacco smokers.
Well, and this is something that scientists and policymakers have looked at and worried about for a long time. In different places, for example, many places in Europe, the connection between marijuana smoking and tobacco smoking is quite strong. In fact, there are cigarettes that are tobacco and marijuana. Back to e-cigarettes and some of the reduced harm products. We see a lot of cycling. People will try different products and move back and forth. And one of the worries about e-cigarettes is a lot of people know that for a person who switches from tobacco to e-cigarettes, there may be a reduced harm. But it's possible that people will continue to use both, that they'll use e-cigarettes and tobacco products and maybe actually prolong tobacco use through the lifetime, and that could be very dangerous.
Point of sale restrictions. Basically, what I'm familiar with is just restricting them to, you know, with regard to young people. Are there any other restrictions?
Point of sale is an emerging policy area. Some people have called it the fifth generation of tobacco policy control. The tobacco industry spends most of its money at the point of sale. You know, it doesn't advertise on billboards anymore. It doesn't advertise on TV. So what it does is it promotes products at the gas station, a lot of advertising, a lot of money spent on displays, a lot of price promotions, tickets, coupons, a lot of sending people gifts, getting them on mailing lists. And this is all meant to create a tie between a user and the product that they're selling. So we're starting to see a lot of policies aimed at point of sale. One of the things that, for example, the FDA was looking at for a while was limiting tobacco retailers that are close to schools or parks. Again, the youth focus, the idea that we didn't want to be exposing children and adolescents to tobacco marketing. There's other – we talked about CVS. There's policy options of limiting where tobacco products can be sold by type of retailer. So CVS did this voluntarily. But some places are considering – some countries are considering options where, for example, no pharmacy could sell tobacco products.
And clearly the tobacco companies putting a lot of pressure on those quick trips and places like that to advertise.
Yes, they're very profitable, and that's where most cigarettes are sold.
We are talking with Doug Luke of Washington University, and we're talking about the idea of ways to reduce smoking in this country as a health measure. And I'll remind our audience that they're listening to St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Let's take another call. We have Marianne joining us from Maplewood. Marianne, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yes. There was a call earlier where the wife said that her husband couldn't stop smoking when he was unemployed. And to me, I smoked for many, well, 3 decades, and I finally realized that through a smoke enders, through the American Lung Association, that when you're, that I was smoking to calm my nerves. It was, I was self-medicating with the cigarettes. And also that women's hormones, when you're PMSing, you really want a cigarette too. And it just seems like they could, well, then I developed exercise and yoga to combat, you know, a lot of this. But it just seems like it might help if there was, you know, this seems to be a very strong factor. And if the science was brought out on this, that people are self-medicating, you know, with the cigarettes, that just, yeah, that's it. Thank you.
All right, Marianne. Interesting talk of self-medication. I mean, it is an addiction, after all.
Yeah, it changes your brain. And this is an important element in many of the treatment programs. So behind the patch, for example. I do want to mention one thing because I think two people have talked about this. You know, there are many resources out there if you want help in quitting. One thing that's available to everybody here in Missouri is the Tobacco Quit Line. It's a free phone call, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, and they can hook you up with a cessation treatment program.
Any other places you can direct audience members to who want to quit and would like to get some help in that area?
Well, many employers have cessation programs, so start looking around at your work. Ask your doctor. The Missouri Health Department and the St. Louis County Health Department would love to direct you towards some programs that may be available to you.
Explain what the role of the FDA is in this. I mean, that's basically the FDA is kind of the overlord of this whole process, isn't it?
Well, and this is relatively new. In 2009, President Obama signed an act, the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act. And one important element of that is it gave FDA for the first time regulatory authority over tobacco products. It's somewhat complicated, but essentially now, for the first time in this country, there is somebody in the government looking at how products are developed, how products are marketed, how new products come to the market. And so it's essentially tougher for the industry to do some of the things they were able to do before that.
Mm. And what kind of teeth can the FDA put into any effort that it might make?
Well, the teeth is the law in the sense that, for example, a new product cannot be introduced anymore in this country without getting FDA regulatory authority. It's treated much like if a drug company wanted to develop a new drug.
We only have about a minute left, Doug. What happens now? Your guidelines are out there. They've been widely distributed. What next?
Well, what next is to understand that there's a lot of science out there. We actually know a lot of what's effective. But as we've seen, not all states and not all communities are able to implement what we know works. And so with our guides, which are user guides, if you will, we are actively promoting the guides, doing trainings with states and communities. And that, in fact, is what public health is trying to do. We're trying to translate the science into actions and into effective policies.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing how well it works for you. Doug Luke, keep us advised as to what you're learning and how well it's working, would you?
Great. Thanks.
That's Doug Luke of Washington University. Coming up, Elevating Cahokia Mounds. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.